It's good to see everyone out this morning. I'd encourage you to go ahead and look back over to Colossians chapter 3. We'll be spending our time really in all three of our lessons today here in this section. It's interesting as we think about how culture changes. One of the ways that that oftentimes shows up is in what we wear. Though we live in a very casual age, it's not been too long ago since clothing really made a pretty big difference. You had certain occasions that dictated certain items that you would wear. For example, you go back just a few years, and if you were attend a wedding or a funeral, you would not think of going in anything, a man, but going in anything but his suit, and a woman in a nice dress. And we would think about black being the color of the funeral, and we think about parties and such that would have appropriate attire. It's interesting that as we consider that some of that is included here in Colossians chapter 3, but applied in a very spiritual sense. But let's begin by going back to where we left off last night. Remember, our conclusion and our introduction both last night was in Colossians verse 4 of chapter 3, where it says, "When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with Him in glory." And so we talked about looking forward to that day, longing for that day, but what I want us to understand is that there is an appropriate attire that we must have on when that day comes. And if you look over just a few verses to verse 12 of the chapter, this is where the Apostle Paul talks about that. He says, "Put on then, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another. And if anyone has a complaint against another, forgiving each other. As the Lord has forgiven you, so you must also forgive. And above all of these, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony." Here's the clothing with which we need to meet the Lord. Here's the attire that's going to show that we're ready for Him. But as we well know, before we put on our good clothes, we want to make sure that everything is right and everything is clean. And so found between these verses that we just read and verse 4 where we left off earlier, what we're going to find is the garments that must be taken off. These garments that we might call the dirty clothes. These garments that are associated with the old man of sin. And so, really, this fits together quite well this morning with these two lessons coming fairly close together in time, that in just a couple of hours here, we can see what it means to take off the dirty clothes and to put on those garments with which we need to be wearing when Christ comes. And so this morning, I encourage you to join with me as we look at these things that the Apostle tells us that we've got to put off if we're going to be ready to meet Him. And so let's consider then these earth-stained garments. And we're going to verse 5 now in the chapter. And he says here, "Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you." The language here is language that needs to get our attention. The idea here is being made dead. The idea that we are putting to death something that no longer needs to be a part of us. And I want us to understand what he's talking about with this, because if we talk about something that's being made dead, it means more than suppression. Do we understand that idea? Sometimes I'm afraid we believe that with these things we're about to look at, as long as we kind of keep them at bay, as long as we keep them suppressed, everything's all right. And that is not what the Apostle says. The Apostle says these things must be put to death. Let me illustrate that concept with a man from right here in South Carolina. I don't know what year this was. Some of you may remember his name from the news of several years ago. A man by the name of Sampson Parker. He was a South Carolina farmer. And one day he did something that all farmers know that they ought not to do. He had a piece of machinery to break. And he reached his hand down into the machinery to fix it. And it caught. And so here he was in the middle of his field, no one around, the road very far away, and his arm was stuck, his hand caught within that equipment. And he struggled and he tried to free it. But in the process of this, to make matters even more grave than they already were, the piece of machinery caught on fire. Here was the decision that he made. His arm was stuck, and it was certain death. And that's when he took out his penknife and put his arm to death. It was a matter of life and death. It was a matter of living, matter of surviving or dying right there. Can you imagine that? But what he knew is that if he did not remove that limb from his body, it was certain death for the whole body. That's the kind of attitude we've got to have when we look at these dirty clothes. As the Apostle Paul goes through one of his vice lists of the New Testament, he's going to list out all of these things and he says, you must put them to death. And I realize that as we talk about these things, that we're going to see in the language of Paul that they've got to be killed. And I know that 9:30 in the morning is a pretty early time to talk about the heady stuff we're about to look at. But I want us to understand there's got to be a seriousness about these things, because we are living in a day and age in which everything we're going to talk about this morning is not only accepted, many times it's applauded. And what you and I have got to be ready to do is to stand up and to say, regardless of what this world says and thinks, regardless of what this world says about me, I'm going to stay faithful and I'm going to put these things to death. And so with that as our premise, we think then to verse 5, these things which are earthly in you, here's what we've got to get rid of. And the apostle begins actually with something that will really be a fairly encompassing term. And in fact, as we consider this first list of vices, there are many folks who say all of these apply to sexual sins, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that. I think that's somewhat of a limitation as we get on down toward the end of it. But these first couple we do know are dealing with sexually oriented sins. And so as the apostle begins his list, he says to us, you must put to death all of these prohibited sexual relationships. Again, if there is anything that is being applauded in our society right now, it's breaking free of any kind of biblical restraints when it comes to sexual relations. I want us to see, though, from the Word of God what He says. And in fact, we're going to go back to the book of Proverbs here for just a minute. Hold your place here in Colossians or put your marker there. And I want you to go back with me to Proverbs chapter 5. The first few chapters of Proverbs are written as a father is speaking to his son. And much of this has to do with adultery and the kind of women to avoid. You can imagine a father giving this advice. And in verses 15 down through 23, he begins talking to his son about how he needs to view his wife. And he puts it in fairly explicit terms here. We look in verse 15. He says, drink water from your own cistern flowing from your own well. Should your springs be scattered abroad, streams of water in the streets? Let them be for yourself alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. A lovely deer, a graceful doe. Let her breast fill you at all times with delight. Be intoxicated always in her love. And at verse 20, he then begins to make his transition. Here is this beautiful picture of marriage, satisfaction within marriage. And then what? Verse 20. Why should you be intoxicated, my son, with the forbidden woman and embrace the bosom of an adulteress? For a man's ways are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his paths. The iniquities of the wicked ensnare him, and he is held fast in the cords of his sins. And then note in particular verse 23 in relation to our point. He dies for lack of discipline, and because of great folly, he is led astray. I tell you, the way the Bible fits together is an amazing thing. And centuries before the Apostle Paul said, you must put to death these things, you've got Solomon saying, if you go to that forbidden woman, that is going to kill you. Therefore, the message is very clear to us. We understand that these things are going to lead to death. This is certainly the case when we think about, as Solomon is mentioning here in this portion of Proverbs, the idea of fornication. The idea of unbridled sexual activity that knows no boundary within marriage. It's interesting. We're fighting an uphill battle with this, aren't we? As we consider the world's view of fornication, that it's really no big deal. In fact, it's quite interesting to look at the statistics, and we see that divorce rates are actually going down. Well, that's not actually good news. The reason is more people are living together. More people are just deciding we're going to move in together and we're not going to bother with traditional marriage. That's fornication. And we have a group of young people, and I guess we've got a generation or two that fit into this category now, that see no moral problem. If you desire this kind of activity before marriage, what though does God say? God says to destroy it, to kill off these desires. And we take that a step further as we think about marriage. And here is a situation where one of the partners within that marriage has been unfaithful. It's interesting that within the past 5 years, I have been associated with two couples whose marriages almost ended because one of the partners was unfaithful. These were Christians. One case, it was the woman who cheated on her husband. In the other case, it was the man who cheated on his wife. And the stress and the strain that was created by that just amplifies what the apostle is saying. He's saying these kinds of things are going to kill you. In the one case, to have watched what that did to the two of them and what it did to their daughter and son-in-law, who are very faithful Christians. And I'm glad to say in both cases that the couples decided to hammer it out and stick together, and I think they're doing well. But their marriages were almost killed by this. Their spirituality greatly diminished for a while because of it. That's why the apostle says we must put these things away from us. And if we consider the big one in the news right now, something that the media and our politicians and our celebrities are saying to us, if you don't accept this, there's something majorly wrong with you. You are homophobic. You are backwards. You are some kind of religious fanatic. And we really don't know an area of the country, do we, where this has not in some way touched us. I was noticing the interstate we were going down, and as I'm sure you've seen those billboards that are lauding the idea. That's everywhere. But what does God say? What does God say about it? We look at Romans chapter 2, verses 27 and 28, and the Apostle Paul explicitly, plainly says, this is not the ways of God. In fact, I'm not a big fan of paraphrase translations. But I happened to be listening to one the other day, and I love the way that they said this, as the man was kind of in his folksy way reading through Romans chapter 1. He came to this section and he said, men forgot what it was like to be men, and women forgot what it was like to be women. And that's exactly right. It's the idea that we're going to the very basis of our creation, where God created the male and female, and we're saying that's of no good to us. And it's another way that the idea, the concept of what the world calls traditional marriage, what you and I call godly marriage, is very much under attack. And I don't care if everybody else in the world says it's okay. You and I stand with God. You and I look to the Word and we say, we love those who are in that sin. We want the very best for them. And that's why we keep preaching the Word of God, to get them out of that sinful thing. But that sexual immorality, and what we've got to do, if that is a temptation to us, is to put that to death. And to say, I will have no part of those things, no matter how tempting it might be. But as we continue in our list in Colossians chapter 3, that's not where the apostle stops. Back in verse 5, he goes on and he says, not only do you put to death sexual immorality, he then says, you put to death the idea of impurity. And again, we find that this particular word, and when you're looking at the Apostle Paul's list, you do well not to say that one's necessarily building on the other. Because a lot of times he's kind of machine gun firing at us all of these different vices and saying, you've got to put all of these to death. In this case, however, I think he is building. Because he says, not only is it that physical act of sexual immorality, it's also the idea of filling your mind with uncleanness. And we look at the word impurity itself, and it means in this situation the uncleanness of thought and of word and of act. So not only are we to refrain from the activity itself, we are to refrain from anything that's going to create that desire within us. Consider that from the words that the Apostle Paul speaks, or actually that our Lord speaks over in Luke chapter 6, when he says, the good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure produces evil, for out of the abundance of the heart his mouth speaks. And therefore, what we're finding in this is the apostle forbidding the idea of these things that are going to create the mindset that will lead to action. So what does that then mean in reality for us? It means that any of those thoughts that are going to produce the fertile ground for fornication, for adultery, for homosexuality, they're removed far from us. We think about modern technology, and it's a wonderful thing. You think about the internet. The internet has revolutionized gaining knowledge, hasn't it? I can remember when I was in college having to spend all those hours in the library. And you have to trudge there, pull the books off the shelves, and then some of them you couldn't check out. And now what do? You type in a few words and it says, oh, there's 2 million hits on this. Now that does produce problems, but nonetheless, you got all of this information at your fingertips, but we know where good is. Satan is not far behind trying to make it evil. And the same place where we can type in and we can find out anything we want intellectually, we can also find any kind of impurity. And that has created, I'm afraid, a very major problem. It's not new. But where once, and I think this plagues men much more than women, men would buy magazines and keep them between the mattresses of their beds so no one could find them. Now in the dark recesses of their home, they can tap into most any kind of impurity imaginable. And I'm amazed at how many men struggle with this particular temptation. I'm amazed at how many people really are addicted. What is that? That's impurity. Someone who says, well, I can look at it, but it's not going to impact me, is a self-deceiver. Because you're creating in your mind things that are going to happen. Surveys have been done of men who are in prison for sexual crimes. You know where almost 100% of it began? Pornography. Therefore, we've got to be careful. But it's not just that. It's also what we're feeding into our minds from our television sets, from the movies that we watch. I'm not going to say to you, okay, now you can watch a movie if it has just this one scene or that scene. You've got to make that decision. Each of us has got to say, is this something that is going to create within my mind a problem? And then get rid of it. The songs that we listen to on the radio or our MP3 players, those things can fill us with such evil thoughts that create this ground of impurity, and therefore we get rid of them. We kill them off. So it doesn't feed this desire to then make that into action. The apostle continues. He says, put away therefore sexual immorality, impurity. And he says, put away passion also and evil desire. And while these can definitely have sexual connotations to them, I believe we don't need to limit it to that, because basically it's an uncontrolled desire. And that can be with anything. That can be with sexually oriented sins, but that can also be with greed. That can be with materialism. It's anything where we're allowing our emotions to get out of control. Listen to what the psalmist tells us as we look to Psalm 36, verses 1 through 4. The psalmist says, transgression speaks to the wicked deep in his heart. There is no fear of God before his eyes. For he flatters himself in his own eyes that his iniquity cannot be found out and hated. The words of his mouth are trouble and deceit. He has ceased to act wisely and do good. He plots trouble while on his own bed. He sets himself in a way that is not good. And then if you notice the last line, it says, he does not reject evil. What then does that mean for us? We exercise self-control. We don't allow ourselves to feed on these things that are going to destroy our character. But take it a step further with the Apostle Paul. He then says, you've got to kill off that idea of covetousness. And with this idea, we're talking about this greediness and this total disregard that we have for others. You know what covetousness really says to us? It says to us that everything is for our personal pleasure. Now, for those who would say that this entire list is still dealing with sexually oriented sins, they would say that this is saying that one looks at another and desires what he or she can get from that person. And that's right. But covetousness can extend far beyond that. Because what I desire is put into the driver's seat. And I believe that's why the apostle associates this with idolatry. What does idolatry do? Idolatry takes something and puts it above God. Now, we always think about an idol, don't we? We think about the golden calf. We think about the little idol of Buddha. We think about all of these different things. That is not the full scope of idolatry. Idolatry is anything that comes before God. And when I take my passions and my desires and my greediness and my disregard for everything else, and I say that my pleasure must come first, I'm an idolater. Just like the guy bowing down in front of that statue. It's exactly what I'm doing. And that's why the apostle says you must put these things away. And as you consider why he says to put them away, he tells us. You look back to our text here to verse 6. He says, on account of these things, the wrath of God is coming. He then goes a step further and he says that the second reason you must put these away, if you look down to verse 7, in these you once walked when you were living in them. He says this is your old man of sin. Those things that were to have been killed off in baptism, you're reviving, you're resurrecting. And he says if you do these things, you're going to be just like you were. And if you're just like what you were, then you must fear the wrath of God. But he's not done with the old clothes, is he? The apostle gives us another list of these vices. And while I think all of us, to some degree or other, are tempted by that first list, I know beyond a shadow of a doubt we're all tempted by the second. Because the apostle then begins and he starts talking about these things that we also must put to death if you go down to verse 8. And he says, but now you must put them all away, anger, wrath, malice, slander, obscene talk, do not lie to one another. In this list, these are the things that perhaps we struggle with more on a daily basis than the ones in the previous. When we think about the words anger and wrath, these two words are virtually synonymous. It's somewhat like we do. If we're trying to drive home a point to somebody, we'll use a string of synonyms to make that point. The apostle does this with the idea under examination. When he talks about anger and wrath, he's talking about a deep-seated hostility. I would describe it kind of like when you're cooking. And as you turn up the heat, especially if you're boiling water, you'll notice before the bubbles start breaking the surface of the water, what's happening down at the bottom? You see those little bubbles forming, don't you? You know things are kind of getting hot down there. That's the anger he's describing. It's not something that's necessarily going to be seen right away, but it's something where we are allowing it to build up within us. We're allowing this hostility to build up within us, knowing that one day that is going to flare. And thus, we understand it's a simmering kind of feeling. And I imagine if all of us are honest with ourselves, we've had that. Something that we have not, perhaps nobody else even knows. But on the inside, we've grown angry. And we didn't get over it. We simply allowed it to stay, to bubble there on the bottom surface. And because of that, get ourselves into danger. You remember what Solomon told us about anger? He says, whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. It's always interesting to do the negative of these. Whoever is fast to anger is not very strong. That's what the apostles say. Here is someone who has not mastered that self-control and has allowed that anger to kind of seethe and to build, looking for the opportunity to flare. And I think that brings us to our second term that he uses here. The idea of malice. It's not a word we use very often anymore. But it's a word that is very descriptive of a dangerous thing, because malice is a general ill will towards someone else. And I would say that it ties with those words that the apostle uses for this reason. Whereas we think about anger in particular, and wrath to an extent, as kind of that below the surface feeling where we're allowing it to build. When we think about malice, it's the idea that we are seeking the occasion to allow that anger to flare. And I might describe it this way. I don't know if you're one of those people, because if you are, I've got some questions about you. Who likes to keep snakes as pets? I've never understood that. But let's just go with it here. And I'm sorry to offend you if you're one of those people. But you ever notice that snake, you got to feed him, right? I don't want to scare our little kids here. You go down to the pet store and you buy something white about this big, right? And you drop it down in there. What does a snake do? It's very still. It's very quiet. And you got the little guy, and he's scampering and running, and the snake's just kind of curled up over there watching. Finally, the little guy starts feeling maybe a little less nervous. He's gone. Why? That snake was looking for its opportunity. That's what anger and wrath does. And malice is the attack. That's why we can't be angry people. Because what we're doing is we are playing with something on the inside that is looking for that opportunity to get at that person who's causing us such trouble. And when the time comes, like that old snake, we're going to strike as hard as we can, and may very well destroy that person and ourselves in the process. That's why the Apostle Paul gives us warning. He says, brothers, do not be children in your thinking. Be infants in evil, but in your thinking be mature. Why do we not get too upset with a two-year-old, maybe who goes up and does some hostility to another two-year-old? It's immaturity. We correct it. It's a lot different when we're adults. And we're allowing these things to happen. Therefore, we remember the words of the Apostle Peter when he says this, "So put away all malice and all deceit and all hypocrisy and envy and all slander." You just get rid of it. And that keeps us from looking for that opportunity to do evil so that we can be the people who do good. And that brings us to the next word in the apostles' list here. When he talks about you put away slander. That idea of slandering is an interesting term. Basically, as it fits into the list here, it's speech that's putting malice into practice. It may not be that we're physically aggressive people. You know, here's somebody that's made me angry, so you know, I go up and let him have it. But sometimes the tongue is mightier than the muscle, isn't it? And what we do is we begin to destroy someone through this verbal barrage. Our purpose in this speech is to destroy another. I never try to pass myself off as an expert in Greek. I have to rely on the knowledge of others. But one thing very interesting I came across as I was preparing this lesson is that that word slander actually comes from the same word as blaspheme. Isn't that interesting? And the idea is what you're doing is you're speaking against someone who's made in the image of God. And thus, in the process, you're blaspheming God. It kind of socks us in the gut, doesn't it? Here is the idea that God is saying when you talk badly of someone else, you are talking badly of me. And that's why we have to be careful. Again, we turn to the wisdom literature for this. And both in Proverbs 10 and verse 18 and in Psalm 101:5, we have these warnings. I'd like to just read them together. "The one who conceals hatred has lying lips, and whoever utters slanders is a fool. Whoever slanders his neighbor secretly, I will destroy." The Lord says, you are destroying someone, and because of that, you will be destroyed. Therefore, we have to understand that slander is something that will tear us apart, and not only us, but those who get in our paths. And therefore, the apostle says, put it away. Put that slander far from you. But then he takes it up one more notch. And he says, you must put away all obscene talk as well. The definition, if we look at this, is basically foul mouth abuse. May I give you the Southern translation? We're talking ugly about somebody. Ever notice that? We use the word ugly in a very good way. Southern English is so much superior to so many other dialects because we know how to use words in their proper context. How many of you, your mother said, don't talk ugly? That's what this is. It's the idea that the slander is not just to everybody around this person, but you're letting this person have it also. The idea of a foul mouth, the idea of blasphemy, the idea that we are talking bad to someone, and it's the attempt to cause harm. And I hope you're seeing that within this entire list, that's what's holding it all together. The anger, the wrath, the malice, the slander. It's all an attempt to destroy someone who is created in the image of God. And therefore we understand that little poem that we learned as a child, "Sticks and stones can break my bones, but words will never harm me," is one of the biggest lies ever told. Words hurt. And you and I know that for two reasons. We've received them and we've given them. And the Lord says, if you are a new man in Jesus Christ, you put those dirty clothes away. because that is not the way that the child of God behaves. And that brings us then to the one that I know for certain we all have in common. That's the idea of lying. All of us have lied. Now, hopefully, as we have grown more spiritually mature, we've given it up. But what's one of the first things parents have to teach their children? What's the natural response of a child? I want to get out of this situation. And however I can get out of this situation, I'm going to do. I remember back when I first started teaching. In fact, Dana, I think this young man was in your class, as a matter of fact. I came in one morning and the school had these, at that time, just these old gas heaters on the floor. And I walked in and the first thing I'd do in the winter is go up and turn the gas up a little bit and fire it up. And I did that. And I came back in and it was out. Young man in the room, I said, why is that out? He said, well, I was sitting here at my desk and my pencil fell off my desk and it rolled up under the heater. And while I was trying to get it, I sneezed. And when I sneezed, it blew the pilot light out. And I said, you gonna tell me the truth now? Kind of hung his head and said, I blew it out. That's a natural thing with a child, isn't it? You think about a 2-year-old, 4-year-old, in that case, maybe a 12, 13-year-old. But when you are in Christ, you take your licks, don't you? And if there is something that we have done, we don't try to lie our way out of it. We stand up, we ask forgiveness, and we understand that in no situation, in no way, is there an excuse for lying. We try to get around that all the time. What if it's going to hurt somebody's feelings? What if it's going to make matters worse? What if? God has been pretty clear on it, hasn't He? You don't lie. Because that represents the old man of sin. Now, as we wrap all of these thoughts together, this is going to lead us into our next series, which is a lot more positive. What's my motivation to change? When I look at this, it's what I used to be. And it's what I don't want to be anymore. It's what was killed off in the waters of baptism, and I don't want it resurrected. And therefore, these qualities of the old self should no longer have a place in my thoughts or my actions. And I also understand with it, very much fitting in with that idea, is that they are totally unlike God. You know, there are some things God can't do. You know what one of them is? God can't lie. Therefore what? I don't lie. How does God handle His anger? How does God handle His wrath? Both are mentioned with God. It's always in the appropriate way. Therefore, I am doing nothing to make myself unlike the Lord. And that takes us to verse 10 in Colossians chapter 3, where the apostle says, "And we have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge after the image of its Creator." And that's what I want to be. Remade, renewed in the image of God. And finally, I've got to ask myself, am I ready to make that change? To put away those garments of wickedness. And as we'll see in our next hour, to put on the garments of Jesus Christ. I appreciate your good attention this morning and look forward to our worship and continuing this study here in just a little while.